can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping?
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you?
You.
This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
What is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? That's the question that we would like to pose to you today. We do that every day right here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Dr. David Anders is in the house ready to take your phone calls. That phone number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we'd still love to hear from you. The number is 205-271-2985, and we will put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email, ctc@ewtn.com, or you can text your question to Dr. Anders. He is a 21st century kind of cat, and you can text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for a response, text your first name and your question, message, and data rates may apply. I'm Jack Williams sitting in today for Tom Price, Michael Birchfield producing the program, Ryan Penny screening your phone calls, and handling our social media endeavors, Mr. Rich Jesse. And the host, as he is every single doggone day on this program, is Dr. David Anders. How in the world are you?
Jack, you know, I'm doing all right. Yeah. A little bit under the weather. So if my
you're taking one for the team. This will
drop
be
to halftime. That's
you
why.
Know, our you can help to make up what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ, and this because of that may be the best show you've ever done. You never know.
There you go. You're right.
I'll take it. We've got some. If you are watching on social media, you can type a question into that chat window, and we may get to it during the course of the hour here. That's what Cecilia did watching on Facebook Live. And she wants to know, would you please talk on the cult Wicca and when it actually came about? Also, did the Catholic Church burn witches?
Thank you. I appreciate the question. So I have to say I don't know that much about the modern history of the modern religious movement called Wicca. My understanding is it was a very intentional ideological movement to recover with modern sort of New Age accents, magic and sorcery and ancient paganism, but it doesn't have any kind of direct continuity to either of those traditions. It's very much kind of a mocked up New Agey religious invention, you know, kind of trying to meld nature religion and paganism with medieval witchcraft and magic. And I would stay far, far, far away from it, because like all superstition, it involves you in sins against the first commandment and potentially opens you up to serious demonic influence.
Well, and that's really the big thing. Even if you don't think that there's anything going on, and even if you don't believe in what they're doing, you can indeed, in fact, open yourself up to things that otherwise may not have affected you, right?
Right, exactly. You know, the Anglican theologian C.S. Lewis, a science fiction and fantasy writer, also wrote a fantasy novel exactly on that theme. His book, That Hideous Strength, is about characters who don't believe in the supernatural, but in fact encounter it and engage it, imagining that it is a merely natural phenomenon, when in fact they're cavorting with demons, and it ends badly for them like it does for everyone who gets involved in that. I remember one time a fellow said to me, you know, why should I do X, Y, and Z? I said, well, quite bluntly, so you don't go to hell. And he said, well, I don't believe in hell. And I said, well, I don't want you to go there not believing in it.
Very good. You know, the former evangelical music artist Keith Green, back in the 70s and early 80s, mm-hmm. had a song called No One Believes in Me Anymore. And it was sung from the perspective of the devil.
Oh, okay.
And he was quite pleased.
So this is like notion. This is like the opposite of the Mick Jagger
That's
song.
Right. That's right. That's exactly right. We received a text from David, and David says, my Protestant cousin tells me that biblically speaking, when you die, you just go to sleep, and no one goes to heaven or hell until the second coming of Jesus. Is this correct?
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So, no, it's not correct. St. Paul says that it's better to be absent from the body and present with the Lord. Jesus himself, in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, discusses the possibility of converse with departed souls. Matthew chapter 17, Moses and Elijah appear on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus. Even the spirit of the prophet Samuel appears to Saul on the eve of his battle with the Philistines. So there's ample biblical witness that there is some kind of intermediate existence between the death of the body and the resurrection of the body at the end of time. Although I will concede this, that the New Testament, the Old Testament, are not particularly concerned to satisfy our curiosity about the state of the soul before the resurrection of the body. That's not the principal concern of the New Testament authors. They're much more interested in the question of the final judgment and what happens when Christ returns in victory. There's sufficient ambiguity, or not ambiguity is the wrong word, but there is a sufficient lack of clarity or specification about that, that your friend is not the only person to have posed this question. And there have been cults and sects and heretical movements throughout history that have postulated this and similar doctrines, soul sleep, psychopanikia is the technical term for it. And in fact, there was actually a Catholic pope, John the 22nd, he was a medieval pope, who toyed around with the doctrine of soul sleep. Now, he did so in contradistinction to the previous 1,500 years of Catholic tradition. And all the theologians at the time were like, what the heck are you doing, Pope, talking that way? And they wrote him some letters and said, would you, you know, you correct this? And he was like, he finally came around and said, okay, you're right, I was just kind of messing around. And the subsequent pope, who was Benedict the 12th, wrote an encyclical, which actually was an exercise of the church's power of infallibility to define the dogma that the souls of the just do immediately see the vision of God upon death. And so that kind of put the nail in that coffin, so to speak, of the doctrine of soul sleep. But it has cropped up from here, there, and yonder, but the church did definitively judge, no, that's a heresy. Souls of the just really do see God. Souls of the wicked really are damned, even prior to the resurrection from the dead.
That's Dr. David Anders. We're asking the question, what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? EWTN's Call to Communion. The phone lines are open at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. You know, a great Lenten practice, if you're not in the practice of going to Mass on a daily basis, is to try to go, you know, at least more than you do. If you go once a week, then maybe a good resolution would be to go, other than Sunday, one day during the week. And if you go a couple of days, maybe try to go 3 days. And a great opportunity to do that, if you can't actually physically get out to Mass, is to join us for the Holy Mass from Our Lady of the Angels Chapel tomorrow morning and every morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time on EWTN radio and television. And tomorrow morning our celebrant will be the head of the community right now, the servant of the community, Father Mark Mary. So be sure to check that out tomorrow and every day at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. Are you ready for some phone calls?
I'm ready.
First up today is Sarah. She is in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on The Quest. Sarah, what's your question today for Dr. Anders?
Hi. I called yesterday, and we didn't quite get to finish talking about it, but I work in a Catholic school, and I was approached by a student yesterday who said that she admitted to me that she was gay, and also said that, you know, I talked to her, just getting some clarifying. She said, well, God wants me to be happy, and this is the way that I can be happy. So I just wanted some clarification and some ways to lovingly steer her in the direction of our Catholic faith.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So knowing the correct Catholic teaching on a particular issue and knowing how to present that pastorally to someone who is in need are two different things. And of the two, the hardest is to know prudently how to present a truth so that someone can be receptive to it. it sounds to me like this particular student is not opening up to you about a difficulty that they have so much as looking for justification for a decision that she's already made. She's already sort of locked onto the ideological narrative that that our culture foists on us, that the way to happiness is to follow whatever it is that our sexual inclinations incline us towards, that that's the path to happiness. How you penetrate that, of course, is going to take listening and openness and affirmation and accompaniment. But I think that the fundamental premise here that needs to be challenged is it the case, I mean, is this true, that the path to happiness is found primarily by following my sexual inclination as the key marker of my identity? That's what we need to call into question. And that she locates this in the mind and the will of God. What is God's ultimate plan for this student and for all of us is that we would be called into loving friendship with Him. And the highest manifestation of that friendship will be without explicitly bodily or sexual union of any kind. We're looking towards an eternity of infinite happiness in God. But it will be an intellectual happiness. It'll be the happiness of the beatific vision, and it will not have an overtly sensual and sexual component. And the character of our lives at present is to mirror that to a certain extent. So even within the sexual relationship of marriage, it is not the sexuality per se of marriage that generates, it may generate pleasure, but it's not that aspect of the relationship that generates transcendent happiness. It is rather the love, and love is something very different from sexual gratification, of laying one's life down in even in suffering, abnegation, self-denial, on behalf of one's spouse or one's children in order to bring them into that kind of loving friendship with God. And the difficulty that we have, all of us, is that our sensuality, that can be our sexuality, but it can be any other kind of sensuality or sensibility, is powerful, it's attractive, and it is in fact a distraction from that kind of transcendent friendship with God that is characterized by self-sacrifice. And so that's the message that has to be communicated. And how you do that, that's going to require prudence on your part. And, you know, I don't know how well you know the student. I don't know how close you are to the student. You have to maintain a certain kind of reserve and distance as a teacher. I mean, there are boundaries that you cannot cross. I don't know if the student mentioned this to you in confidence or if you're allowed to talk about it with other adults. But that may be a place you want to start also, is to see, you know, ask the student's permission to draw other people who are better placed to speak into this child's life in an authoritative way into this conversation. I would ask a lot of questions. What is it that leads you to this conclusion about yourself? Is it just that, you know, you have certain inclinations? What leads you to think that those inclinations become the single or primary identifier for who you are? As opposed to just passing inclinations, what makes you think that following inclination, following passion or appetite is the way to transcendent happiness? I mean, these are the kinds of questions. What is it that makes you think that it is God's design for you that you should do these things? Nothing in Revelation, nothing in the teaching of Jesus would incline us to the conclusion that because I have a sexual appetite, I'm supposed to follow it. On the contrary, Jesus endorses the idea of radical continence, radical chastity, as the purity of heart without which no one will see God. When the Pharisees asked Christ about human sexuality in Matthew chapter 19, his retort was that some people make themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven, but those who are not given that gift are called to the kind of radical self-denial entailed by marriage. Would she approve the idea of her father or her mother leaving the family to pursue their private sexual fantasies simply because they had them. I mean, the logical implications of that position are life-destroying, they're family-destroying, and they're society-destroying. They're very, very egocentric. What matters is what I want to do with my body for my pleasure. That's a very, very destructive position. If we lived that way consistently, what would become of our loved ones, of our civilization? I mean, these are kinds of questions you can ask. But again, you have to do it in a very pastorally sensitive way. And you may not have the right to speak those questions into this child's life. So you may want to bring other people into the conversation.
God bless you, Sarah. We'll keep you in our prayers as you have those conversations going forward. A couple of lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Next up is Doug in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening to Sacred Heart Radio. Doug, you're on with Dr. Anders.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, I attend a parish that says the traditional Latin Mass. I believe they fall under Society of St. Pius X, SPX. And my question to you is, do they fall under Rome's rule? So basically, quick story, was married at a very young age, just joined the Marine Corps, got married, and in this church, the bishop there gave us his blessing. We got married, and a few years later, we ended up getting divorced. Is that marriage recognized under Rome's rule, or is this the parish I attend completely separate from what Rome is doing?
Okay, so the question: you were married at an SSPX chapel by an SSPX priest, and this was some time ago. Is that correct?
Yeah, 2004.
Four. Okay, that marriage is not going to be considered valid by the Catholic Church because the priest who celebrated that wedding at that time did not have valid jurisdiction to witness the promises of marriage. And today, the law of the Church is subtly different. Rome has made a provision where the local bishop in your diocese can, if he chooses, grant jurisdiction to priests of the Society of St. Pius X to validly witness marriage vows. He doesn't have to do that, but he can. But in 2004, he would not have had that option, and so the priest who witnessed that marriage would not have had valid jurisdiction from a bishop to do that, and so that marriage would lack canonical form and would be on that basis invalid. So it would be a slam dunk easy case to obtain an annulment from the marriage tribunal of your diocese for that particular wedding ceremony. It would be null and void, and a marriage tribunal would find that very quickly.
Is that helpful, Doug?
From that, absolutely. And then just going forward from that, I would be able to participate in the other sacraments, such as confession and taking communion.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. If provided that you're in the state of grace and you meet the proper conditions, you've been to confession and aren't conscious of mortal sin, all that sort of thing. So, if you were involved in an illicit relationship that was not a valid marriage, you know, there'd be matter there to bring up in the confessional, and you need to do that and get absolved. But yes, I mean, with the declaration of nullity, there's no barrier to your participating in the rites and sacraments of the Catholic Church, provided you're in the state of grace and you're Catholic.
Thanks, Doug. We appreciate that call. Plenty of time for your phone calls at 833-288-EWTN. We're asking the question, as we do every day at this time, what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Is there one teaching that has kept you from digging deeper into the possibility of looking into the Catholic faith? Perhaps you've kind of been on the brink of converting and something has held you back. We'd love to talk to you about that today at 833-288-3986. We head next to Great Falls, Montana. Ken is in Great Falls, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Ken, what's your question today for Dr. Anders?
Hi, good afternoon. I was just curious, as a convert, I don't understand why people don't dive into what the truth is, go back in the history of where the church came from. And in your opinion, what do you think prevents people from wanting to find out what the truth is? Being a lifelong Catholic, I was approached by other religions, but when you look into them, you can find out that it's just somebody made up their mind and went astray. So, and then just how to help people start to mine into what the truth is and how to find the answer.
Sure. I really appreciate the question. And there's a lot we can say about this. First of all, to have faith in divine revelation in the Catholic Church requires a gift of grace. And the motives of credibility, those evidences for the divine authority of the Catholic faith, are genuine motives to make it rational to believe in Catholicism, to see that there is objective evidence that the Catholic Church speaks with divine authority. But actually to be moved by those motives to the point of surrendering one's will in obedience to the authority of God in the Catholic Church, that requires an act of supernatural grace. And it is manifest that not everyone who confronts those evidences will so submit, and not everyone has that grace. And even those to whom God extends grace, it remains possible for them to resist grace. I remember in my own journey, there was a moment in time when I recognized if I am to follow Christ intelligently as an intellectually fulfilled Christian, I can only do so as a Catholic. To become Catholic is going to cost me a lot emotionally and socially and in my family life, and I do not wish to pay that price. I will not so submit. And I had about a year in limbo where I refrained from becoming Catholic, not for any intellectual reason, but because it was too costly to do so. This is something that Jesus anticipates. He says, before you go build a tower, make sure you count the cost so you don't get stuck halfway up and look like an idiot.
Concepts are very attractive until you have to get your wallet out, huh?
Until you have to get your wallet out, exactly. So that's part of the answer. But I also think that there are people who are interested in the question of truth, abstractly, but they have an antecedent commitment to a particular concept, image, totem, symbol, you name it, that is for them the kind of like the final determining factor. When I was in seminary, I was a Protestant. I was in a Protestant seminary. I had many professors that were brilliant men and women who knew the history of Christianity very, very well. But the one presupposition from which they would never move was that Luther was correct about the doctrine of justification and that the Catholic Church was wrong. And so they brought their prodigious learning and intellects to bear to defend that particular presupposition. So everything else in their learning was going to come to support that one unexamined assumption. But without examining that assumption, they would never move from that particular house of cards. And I think everyone does this to a certain extent. You know, for some it might be their Protestant commitment to Luther. For someone in the 21st century secular world, maybe it's their commitment to sexual libertinism. Maybe the thing that they will never question is their right to follow their sexual passions wherever they may lead them, and they're willing to contemplate any religious system provided it doesn't challenge that one superstitious belief. I remember one time reading an ethnography about primitive religion, this particular group that did something very silly that I don't have time to tell you about because here comes the music. But that was the thing they weren't going to give up, you know? And that's superstition is embedded in the human heart. It takes an act of grace to uproot it.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. 833-288-3986. Plenty of time for your calls on Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Those numbers again, 833-288-EWTN, toll free anywhere in North America, 833-288-3986. 3986. What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic? And we answered a question from Cecilia on Facebook Live at the beginning of the program, Dr. Anders. And Cecilia must be watching on Facebook today because she points out we didn't get to the second part of her question, did the Catholic Church burn witches?
Yes, I appreciate the question. So for 2,000 years, Catholics have affirmed the legitimacy of the death penalty for certain felonies in civil society. And so in Catholic civilizations, up until very recently, including, I might add, in the Vatican City-State, the Papal States, executions have been performed for criminals who are guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors, including but not limited to the civil crime of practicing black magic. So have sorcerers and heretics been executed for civil crimes against the state, and heresy could be defined in the criminal code as a crime? The answer to that question is yes. Now, are we doing it at present? No. But has it happened historically? Yes, it has. It's worth placing that in context, however. It is not only Catholics that have treated sorcery and black magic as a crime that is subject to the penal code, keep in mind, in the 17th century, when pilgrims were fleeing to the New World to escape religious persecution and, you know, from the state of England, the Protestant state of England, you could be executed in England in the 17th century for stealing a glove. All right, for stealing a glove. I mean, for crimes that we would barely consider punishable, most societies throughout history have not hesitated to impose the death penalty. And the idea of breaking the veil between here and the world of darkness and exposing yourself, your loved ones, and your society to grave spiritual danger has always been treated as a very, very serious offense. Now, it is a serious offense. Now, we no longer judge it prudent to execute people for doing that. But that's not unique to the Catholic world. Protestant jurisdictions would have done the same thing. Jewish jurisdictions in antiquity would have done the same thing. Islamic jurisdictions would have done the same thing. And even in the pagan world, you would have found a precious little tolerance for certain forms of magic and superstition. In fact, one of the reasons why the Romans put Christians to death in antiquity was precisely because they thought that Christians were practicing certain forms of black magic, necromancy, and necrophilia, because they would have so-called love feasts in cemeteries and eat and drink the body and blood of a guy named Jesus. And the Romans went, "That's some creepy stuff, man. We're going to kill you for it." So that attitude is one that's extraordinarily common across civilizations and throughout history. The fact that we now regard that kind of thing with distaste is in fact due to the Catholic doctrine of the dignity of the individual, something that you don't find universally throughout human cultures. Many cultures view individuals as so many fingernail clippings on the end of the body politic that you can dispense with, you know, without concern. And the whole idea of human rights or human dignity is effectively a Catholic idea. And the fruit of that seeded into civilization is the kind of regard for the human person that has now eventuated in a resistance to things like the death penalty for these kinds of crimes.
We have phone lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's toll-free anywhere in North America. If you're outside the United States and Canada, your number is 1-205-271-2985, and we'll put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. Kevin is also watching on Facebook Live, and he says, why do the Greek Orthodox believe that Catholics are in schism with them rather than them with us? Who was their quote-unquote founder?
Okay, I appreciate it. So, when you go back into 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th century, there is no position other than that Rome has the primacy because it has inherited it from St. Peter. When the question about which of the patriarchal churches is preeminent, it's unanimous that it's Rome. Why is it Rome? Well, because Rome has inherited the See of St. Peter. That is the universal position. When the capital of the empire moved from Rome to Constantinople, you find some Byzantine Eastern theologians who float the idea, well, perhaps we should move the patriarchal see, the preeminent see, the Petrine see, from Rome to Constantinople because the political empire has moved. And they floated that idea at the Council of Constantinople, and it was uniformly rejected by the Pope and by the bishops. So it was a novel idea. No, that's not the Catholic faith, they said. And so you had a united one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church for basically a millennia. There was a patriarch of Constantinople in the Middle Ages named Photius, who attempted to reject the authority of the Pope, but he was eventually reconciled to the Pope on his deathbed. It was basically over the legitimacy of his appointment to the patriarchate, and he wanted to appeal to Rome to defend his position, and Rome refused, and so then he said, okay, well, I reject the authority of Rome, but he was ultimately reconciled to Rome. And so the formalizing of the Byzantine rejection of Roman authority took place really in steps over centuries, over more or less political concerns. So Michael Cellularius in the 11th, 12th century, no, 11th century, would have been one who I suppose you could name him as a key figure in this division. But it really unfolded over the course of centuries. It kind of was solidified by the time of the Fourth Crusade when the Latin Crusaders sacked the city of Constantinople. That unsurprisingly did not go down well with the Byzantine Empire, and the rupture was more or less complete. So I hope that answers your question. Now, Michael, are we ready to go to Angela in Raleigh, North Carolina? Okay, we got a call waiting from Angela. Jack had to step out for a second. So, Angela, welcome to Call to Communion.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
What can I do for you?
My question was, because I experience this sometimes, why do we seem to have to struggle and wrestle more with temptation when we're trying to make a change or give something up? I mean, it's Lent, but not just Lent.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So God, of course, could have created us such that we loved him above all things and our neighbor as ourselves of necessity. He could have made us that way. Or he could have confirmed us in grace after one act of obedience, like he did the righteous angels. When God created the angelic hosts, most of them immediately submitted their wills to God, and they were confirmed forever in grace and admitted to the beatific vision, and it's impossible for them ever to sin. Some of them didn't, and he consigned them to hell, and they became the devils, the demons, and he could have made us that way. He could have made us always to know and love him, or he could have made us with that one test that we would succeed, and then he gives us possibility of being confirmed in grace and never falling again. But he didn't make us that way. He made us so that in this life we're on a journey. And why did he do that? Well, there's one hint that I know of in the Gospels as to why. Excuse me, got a little cold. Jesus said, there is more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous people who do not need to repent. And so we have to conclude that there's something beautiful in the story of a soul that wrestles manfully, that wrestles heroically against temptation and overcomes. That's praiseworthy and noble in a way that justifies God in creating us with the possibility of living in this condition. There are select souls in history that he has confirmed in grace. You know, there's a story about the life of St. Thomas Aquinas, that he was confronted in a poignant way with the temptation to lust, to impurity, and that he resisted that temptation heroically, and that he was confirmed supernaturally in the gift of chastity such that it never was a problem for him again. That's not the case for most of us. And when we resist temptation, we actually have an opportunity to acquire merit. You know, Jesus says that if you give even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones because they belong to me, you will not lose your reward. So when we do these things, when we face up against temptations and trials, it is an opportunity for us to merit, to please God, and to even place those merits at the service, at the good of the universal church. And our enemy, the devil, is not interested in our living the virtuous life, and so he's going to be there at our elbow in a flash trying to draw us away. And as we resist him, stand firm, resist the devil, St. James says, and he'll flee from us. That's an opportunity for us to merit. Now, as we are habituated to doing the good, we will develop virtues, and it'll become easier and easier to do the good. But you're correct. I mean, temptation is difficult. It is the course of our daily life. It's why we pray in the Lord's Prayer, lead us not into temptation. And the best remedy for this, of course, is the spiritual disciplines, the life of prayer, penance, the sacraments, fasting, abnegation, alms, all of these things, meditation on the last things, meditation on the crucifixion of Christ, and the rewards of heaven. All of these things are antidotes to the difficulties of temptation. I appreciate the question, Angela. Thank you so much. The number to be on the show is 1-833-288-EWTN, 1-833-288-3986. Can we go now to Lisa in Sandusky, Ohio? Lisa, welcome to Call to Communion.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, good. I'm in the car with my son, Jackson. We listened to Call to Communion when I picked him up from school.
Okay.
And he asked me if I could call in and ask a question. I told him yes. He wants to know, he's five, he wants to know, and I've explained this question to him the best I could before, is Noah's Ark a true story?
Okay, thanks. All right, Lisa, I appreciate the question, and I appreciate your son asking. So here's what I'm going to tell you, and you may not be satisfied with this answer. When you read the story of Noah's Ark, what does God want you to know about this story? What does he want you to get out of it? And clearly, Noah was obedient to God, and God preserved him. Noah was obedient to God, and God preserved him. Now, the New Testament tells us that Noah's Ark is a symbol for Christians who pass through the waters of death in baptism. And so, whether or not there was a Noah who floated in a boat, it remains true God wants us, like Noah, to love him and to obey him and to make use of the sacraments and the church, which is like our ark today. I mean, the world is awash in a flood of sin and temptation, and God has provided a ship, a boat for us. And that is the Catholic Church. So we need to be obedient to God and stay on the boat. And that's the Catholic faith. And if we persevere to the end, we'll be saved. That's what we need to know about Noah and the ark. And questions about, you know, was there a man named Noah and when did he live? These things are interesting and we can explore them. But they're not the most important thing that we need to know from the story.
Is that helpful, Lisa?
Yes.
Yeah.
Was that helpful, Jack?
Yeah.
All right,
hey, thanks, Jack.
Good job out of you, buddy. He is obviously a brilliant child named Jack. The number to be on the program is 833-288-3986. That's 833-288-EWTN. You know, there's a lot of, it's not just Noah's Ark. There are other Old Testament accounts that the same answer really applies to. And for parents who are talking to their small children sometimes, the Catechism of the Catholic Church does a really nice job in a lot of these instances of kind of laying out what a responsible Catholic ought to believe about such things.
Sure, sure, absolutely. That's correct.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Ben was watching on Facebook, and he writes in, when Jesus ascended, I like this, did he literally rise into the air like a rocket, only slower?
Sure. So he rose into the air. He surely did. I don't know that it was like a rocket. I don't know if we had, you know, spouts of flame shooting out of his sandals. That'd be kind of cool if he did. But yeah, it was a literal bodily ascension.
So you could have witnessed it if you had been there.
If you'd have been, you know, I had, now that you say that, I had the great opportunity when I was in seminary to study with the Protestant theologian Carl F. H. Henry, who was one of the big names in Protestant evangelicalism in the 20th century, and a keen defender of the doctrine of Christ's bodily resurrection. And he tells the story about being in Washington, D.C., when the Swiss theologian Karl Barth came to speak in the United States. And Barth was something of an international rock star at the time, but not somebody who concerned himself overly with the question of the historicity of the resurrection. And Carl Henry at the time was the editor of Christianity Today. So he jumps up at the press conference and gets the first question in, and he says, "Professor Barth, we're gathered here with all these reporters from around the country to hear you speak. On Easter Sunday, if this same body of reporters had been present at the tomb of Christ, would Jesus' emergence from the tomb have been the kind of event that they could have reported in the newspaper, one that they would have been able to witness empirically and then put down as, you know, having had happened?" And he said that Barth got angry with him and shot back, "Did you say Christianity Today or Christianity Yesterday?" And Carl Henry, not being slow on the draw, said Christianity Yesterday, Today, and Forever. And, you know, to this today, I don't share the faith of Carl Henry. He was a Baptist and I'm a Catholic. But I was deeply appreciative of that story and of his answer.
It's a clever way to ask the question.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Was.
Back to the phones we go. Deacon Tim is in Peoria, Illinois. Boy, there are some beautiful churches in Peoria, Illinois. He's listening on St. Bernadette Radio. Deacon Tim, you're on with Dr. Anders.
Hello. God bless you guys. And
hey,
thank
Deacon.
You for what you're doing.
Thank you for what you're doing.
About 6 months ago. Thank you. Our Bishop Daniel Janke reinstituted the prayer at every low mass in the Peoria Diocese back in 2012, the prayer of St. Michael the Archangel. And so at all low masses on Sunday, it is said. I decided to do a poll about 6-7 months ago with the faithful on whether or not they know the history of that prayer, where it came from, and 99.4%, jokingly, say they had no idea. And so when I kind of explain it to them, they talk about, we're asking to cast Satan into hell. I thought he was already cast into hell at the beginning when he, on his original denial of God and God's supremacy. And my answer to them is no. And I go into explanation, but I'd like, if you could kind of help me to further that cause of explaining to them that we are susceptible, that he is working very overtime here on earth, and not necessarily has he been cast into hell.
Sure. I appreciate the question a lot. So, you know, the New Testament tells us that our enemy, the devil, roves around like a lion, prowls around like a lion, looking
a
for
roaring lion.
For whom he might devour. And direct confrontation with the forces of evil was integral to the ministry of Christ, especially in the Gospel of Mark. Jesus seems to be an exorcist par excellence. Above everything else, he's confronting demons and casting them out. And this is part of the charge that he gives to his apostles, that they cast out demons, heal the sick, and preach the good news. And this is so much a part of the Christian tradition that in antiquity, when you read the fathers of the church, a writer like Tertullian will report that it is the exorcisms that Christians performed in the public square that had the greatest evangelistic impact on the pagans around them. It wasn't so much the appeal of the message as it was the demonstration of power over the forces of evil. Ramsay McMullen, who's a secular historian, concludes, without, you know, passing judgment on the reality of what's taking place in exorcism, that this was the most characteristic Christian activity to be witnessed by pagans in antiquity, the practice of exorcisms, and had a powerful impact on how the church was perceived in the world. So clearly, and today, as you know, every bishop is, by definition, the chief exorcist of his diocese, although he generally delegates that work to a specific priest in his jurisdiction who carries that out on a regular basis. And so just because the faithful don't see it happening, because it's usually done behind closed doors and in secret, for obvious reasons, Generally, there's an exorcist who's working overtime in every diocese dealing with this stuff all the time, all the time. My priest, actually, at my parish just this past week, preached on this question and told some anecdotes about times when he had personally been involved in exorcisms and how it literally scared the hell out of him, you know. And so it's very real. Now, what is this business about casting Satan into hell if he's already in hell? Well, clearly, Satan is alienated from the presence of God and does not enjoy the beatific vision, does not enjoy God's presence, and is conscious of his utter rejection. And yet, there does seem to be there is for certain, we know, that he has a free hand on earth to a certain extent that he will lose when Christ finally culminates his victory at the second coming. And the ministry of exorcism is a kind of anticipation of that. And we know anecdotally from the stories of exorcists that when they confront demons, the demons are loath to respond to the command to leave the demoniac and to be cast into hell. So, you know, metaphysically, what does that entail for a demon who's already in despair because of his hatred of God to be consigned even further to hell? I don't think we really know the details about that. But there is something that they can suffer now that they don't suffer, but they do at the hands of exorcists. And that's about the best that we can do. And this will all become plain to us, of course, when Jesus comes back.
You know, if you missed this episode of Call to Communion or any of our shows, don't fear. We record them all. We make them available to you via podcast. And you can check out all of those archived audio programs at EWTN.com/podcast. Back to the phones we go. Sarah's in Wake Forest, North Carolina, listening to EWTN Radio. Sarah, you are on with Dr. David Anders.
Hi.
What's your question?
So I have a question about some of my Protestant family tend to ask me the same question, and I haven't really had the greatest of answers for them. So in a lot of texts in the Bible, we as Catholics say that certain things are not to be taken literally, that it's really the lesson that we're learning from them. And, but then they want to know, well, then how do you know then when Jesus says, this is my body, that instance is literal?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. In a lot of ways, and I'm going to start enumerating a few of them. One of them, and I'm going to use a fancy German word here because it's a technical word from biblical studies. One of them has to do with the Sitz im Leben of the Gospel of John. Sitz im Leben means the situation in life. What is the Gospel of John? Why was it composed? To what audience and for what purpose? And it's evident from its historical situation that the Gospel of John was written to a pre-existing Christian community that was already conversant with the life of the sacraments. They're already celebrating. So John isn't telling them about the sacraments. He's writing a community that is celebrating them and saying, here's a mystical text for you to use in your sacramental celebration. So in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, St. Paul does the same thing. He adverts to a pre-existing sacramental tradition that is earlier than the text of the Bible itself, when he says, the tradition that I receive from the Lord, I hand on to you. And then he enumerates the elements of the liturgy. And part of the thing that he hands on, that he talks to them about, is the reality of Christ's corporeal presence in this sacramental celebration. It's precisely why the Corinthians have to behave properly. They can't have any schisms among them. They can't have any sexual immorality among them. Because if they do, then they are going to partake of the body and blood of the Lord in an unworthy manner, and then therefore be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. So just as Paul is adverting to a pre-existing liturgical tradition that presupposes the bodily presence of Christ in their midst, so too the Gospel of John does that. So John is writing to people who are going to be reading the Gospel of John, and they're like, oh yeah, we know what he's talking about. When Jesus says in John chapter 3, unless you're born again in water and the Spirit, he speaks in an oblique way, but his listeners would have known instantly, oh yeah, he's talking about baptism. In the same way when Christ says, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you don't have life. Now, there's an interesting a dramatic irony in the text, because the characters in the narrative don't know what he's talking about. All right? Now, you know what? Literary irony is when the reader knows something that the characters don't know. And John uses a form of literary irony, because the characters don't know how Jesus is going to pull this trick off,
But the reader, who's already celebrating the liturgy, goes, ah, I get it. That's what he's talking about. Now, here comes the music. If I had more time, I could give you more proofs. I will just say John also has to be read in the canonical context of all the four Gospels. And the other three institution narratives all say, this is my body. And Christ said what he meant what he said, and speaks with divine authority. And we can situate that later in the sacrificial and cultic history of Israel to make more sense of it. But that's enough to go on for the time being.
Thanks so much, Sarah, for your question. Thanks to all of our listeners and all of our email questions and our phone questions. Back at it tomorrow on EWTN's Call to Communion. Until then, God bless.